Today is Tuesday, December 11th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, France's president speaks to his nation amid weeks of protest and turmoil. In neighboring Britain, today's Brexit vote is on hold.
As a result, if we went ahead and held the vote tomorrow, the deal would be rejected by a significant margin. We will therefore defer the vote scheduled for tomorrow.
The U.S. joins Turkey, Russia, and Kuwait in opposing language in a world climate agreement. Also ahead, a superhero sighting in U.S. theaters.
What could be greater than a king?
A hero.
It's all on today's International Edition.
I think we'll see next weekend if it resonated, if the Yellow Vests decide to resume their movement. It was a very humble speech. It was a fairly short speech from Macron.
French President Emmanuel Macron was both humble and resolute late Monday as he spoke publicly for the first time. On the weeks of anti-government protests that have shaken the country, he said he takes his share of responsibility for words that may have hurt people in the past. In a nationwide broadcast speech, Macron also said he recognizes that a proposed tax hike on pensions was unjust, but he called the anger that has boiled over in the past weeks the result of what he describes as a 40-year-long malaise, especially among rural French. The president declaring an economic and social state of emergency, but Macron also stood firm against the street protesters, saying there will be no indulgence for those who smash windows, loot stores, and attack police. Macron also had already canceled the fuel tax hike that sparked the protests nearly a month ago. The anger then expanded beyond the tax to a general outrage against a president many protesters say cares more about the rich than ordinary French American or citizens. Protests in Paris forced police to temporarily shut down major tourist sites, including the Eiffel Tower. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Ben Haddad of the Atlantic Council if he thinks Macron's speech will calm things down.
I think we'll see next weekend if it resonated, if the Yellow Vests decide to resume their movement. It was a very humble speech. It was a fairly short speech for Macron, 13 minutes, where he tried to find a balance between confronting and condemning the violence that we've seen in the streets of Paris and major French cities in the last few weekends, but at the same time, acknowledging and responding to the anger that has fueled this movement. He announced a few concrete measures, from increasing the minimum wage or stopping taxes on low-income retirees, among others, but at the same time, clear that he would not back down from reforming the country. I think his objective was to respond to anger and break the popular support for this Yellow Vest movement that has gathered something like 70% of support from the French population.
He said the distress doesn't date from yesterday. He talked about 40 years of malaise that has finally come to the surface. What does he mean?
He means that he was elected already as a candidate of discontent and anger at the French establishment. Remember that Emmanuel Macron was completely unknown 2 years before running for office. He created his own party from scratch, ran something like 90% of new candidates at the National Assembly. There is this deep anti-establishment feeling in France that he captured, albeit in a moderate liberal way, breaking the two-party system. And so he's basically saying, you elected me for this. You elected me to change the country because we've been in inertia for decades from both the left and the right, so give me a chance to do that. So I think he's trying to say that all the ills that the yellow jackets, yellow vests are talking about are not new. This sluggish growth, this very high unemployment, high youth unemployment, this didn't start with Macron. It is actually the result of the decades of poor economic policy.
Among the measures he announced was a 100 euro or $113 monthly increase in the minimum wage as of next year, for which businesses will have to foot the bill. Is this going to be enough?
Once again, we'll see next weekend. He announced two things, a few concrete measures immediately that will alleviate some of the pressure on purchasing power, on quality of life that have been really at the heart of this movement that started as a protest against the gasoline tax, but really expanded way beyond to a larger discontent about inequalities and quality of life. But I think beyond this, said, look, we're going to accelerate some of the reforms. We're going to open conversations about all these issues, from climate change to immigration to the labor market. So I think see this also as the beginning of a second sequence, a second phase of his presidency that will allow him to go further and maybe be more ambitious than he's been so far. It'll be very complicated because obviously he is right now very unpopular. This movement has been supported by a majority of the French. So we'll see if he manages to relaunch a momentum for his presidency after this.
Ben, he waited weeks after these protests began to respond publicly. Why did it take him so long?
It's a good question. I think he has wanted to let the government first deal with it for a little while. We've seen the prime minister and the interim minister mostly. I think he was waiting for the violence to abate and to calm down the situation, to get under control before announcing measures and not give the impression he was giving in front of this movement. But he has been very criticized because of this in the last few weeks. And I think a lot of people have wondered why it has taken him so long to respond to this.
He has more than 4 years left in his term. What happens to his reform program?
It's a very good question because obviously he has a five-year term. There's nothing in the Constitution that can prevent him from finishing this term, but there's obviously the risk of being a lame duck after 18 months in office. So we'll have to see first what the speech results in terms of popularity. He still has a strong majority in parliament that doesn't change. The question will be obviously public support and reaction from the street. There's a very critical election, which is the European election coming next spring, and he has put a lot of hopes into this because European reform is at the heart of his message. So it'll be a very difficult test for him to regain the momentum and the control, I would say, of his presidency.
That's Ben Haddad with the Atlantic Council speaking from Paris. British Prime Minister Theresa May has postponed Parliament's vote on her European Union divorce deal to avoid a shattering defeat, a decision that throws her Brexit plans into chaos. All signs have pointed to a big defeat for the Prime Minister in the vote planned for Tuesday.
I've listened very carefully to what has been said in this chamber and out of it. To what has been said in this chamber and out of it by members from all sides. From listening to those views, it is clear that while there is broad support for many of the key aspects of the deal, on one issue, the Northern Ireland backstop, there remains widespread and deep concern.
But postponing the vote is a fresh humiliation for May, who became prime minister after Britain's 2016 decision to leave the EU. May has been battling on Brexit ever since, first to strike a divorce deal with the bloc, then to sell it to sceptical British lawmakers before the UK leaves the bloc on March 29th. Both Conservative and opposition Labour Party lawmakers have said they wouldn't back the divorce deal that May and EU leaders agreed on last month. Joining us now from London is London-based journalist Amy Gutman. Amy, how surprising was this delay on the vote?
It was quite a surprise when the vote was canceled. This has been a hotly anticipated vote. And now I think is when we find out what Theresa May is really made of, whether she can drive a hard bargain with the EU or not. And in many respects, she doesn't have a choice. She has one last chance to go to Brussels. Whatever occurs tomorrow in Parliament, the facts remain. She has to go to Brussels and come back with an agreement that will pass in Parliament and will offer a backstop for Ireland. And the real problem is that, you know, the current agreement is actually worse than if the UK stayed in the EU. So that, the majority feeling, that's widely believed to be true. It's not something that one part of the or the other is alleging or contending. So she has no choice. She has got to get a better deal. She did not negotiate a good deal. And many people are speculating that that's because she actually sent in civil servants to do the deal rather than politicians who would have been able to negotiate better, which I think is an interesting distinction here. Essentially, the whole agreement really rests on this notion of this backstop with Ireland and the UK having the right to exit the backstop. This backstop agreement with Ireland, Ireland is in this unique position because it's part of the EU, but it's part of the UK. Northern Ireland is part of the EU. The Republic of Ireland is part of the UK. And so the problem is that right now we don't have hard borders in between the UK and Ireland. And so the EU was pushing for hard borders. But that would be problematic for everyone, particularly Ireland and the UK. In fact, it would be worse for Ireland because creating hard borders, they were talking about setting up a border in the Irish Sea. It would be very bad economically for Ireland to set up hard borders. And it would be very bad for the UK as well. It would essentially partition Ireland away from the UK. So it gets very complicated. But basically what the EU has been doing is leveraging the situation with Ireland in individual cases. This has been really the problematic piece of this agreement. If Theresa May does not get a better agreement from Brussels, Parliament will say no and will potentially go down the path where the UK will leave the EU next March with no deal. But with no deal also comes a penalty for the EU, because if there's no deal, then the UK will not pay the £39 billion unpaid bill that it owes the EU. And that's big money. I mean, that could bankrupt the EU. So ultimately, some agreements are likely to be put in place, even if not the big agreement.
Why did Theresa May decide to stop the vote?
Theresa May postponed the parliamentary vote on Brexit for two main reasons, the first of which is because the EU Court of Justice ruled that Article 50 could be revoked, that the UK can unilaterally halt the Brexit process, which, of course, it's hoping the UK will do. There is a faction in the UK that wants another referendum. Theresa May has said unequivocally that she will not hold another vote, that the people have spoken, and that even though she voted to remain, she will fulfill the people's wishes. So it's not looking like another vote or referendum, shall we say, is likely, though there are those who are still campaigning for that. But more importantly, that gave her permission, essentially, to postpone tomorrow's parliamentary vote on the agreement. It has given her, in essence, this permission to renegotiate, even though the EU is actually holding out, saying, we're not renegotiating. But even in that, there's still the opportunity for her to go back to Brussels. And it's widely believed that, indeed, yes, she will renegotiate, or she will at least attempt to renegotiate this deal. I mean, that's what politics is all about. So it was that one event. It was the fact that the EU Court of Justice ruled that the UK could halt the Brexit process that allowed her to stop this mechanism with the parliamentary vote. And she postponed that vote specifically because she knew there would not be enough support for it, because she knew that vote would fail, because there isn't much support for it, because largely it's believed not to be a fair deal for the UK.
Is it possible that they could do a U-turn on Brexit?
It's possible, but it's unlikely. And the political will, though it exists with a small minority of Brits within the greater society, I would say there's a grassroots campaign for a second referendum. And again, the EU would very much like to see a second vote. They believe that it would fail if it was voted on a second time. But Theresa May has always stipulated that she will never hold a referendum, that that would defeat the whole point of democracy.
All right. That's London-based journalist Amy Gutman. Thanks for being with us. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. High prices and shortages lead to Venezuelans scouring garbage for food. Trump is looking at several candidates to be the new chief of staff. A Chinese court bans iPhone models in a patent dispute. And Kenyans hunted for being albino. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Saudi Arabia's foreign minister has ruled out the extradition of suspects in the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi after Istanbul's chief prosecutor filed warrants for the arrest of two former senior Saudi officials. Emily Wither reports from the Turkish city.
Saudi Arabia has ruled out extraditing any suspects in the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. It comes after Istanbul's chief prosecutor filed warrants for the arrest of two former senior Saudi officials.
With regards to issuing an arrest warrant, we don't extradite our citizens. I believe Turkey's constitution prohibits the extradition of Turkish citizens.
Turkish officials say they have strong suspicion that Saad al-Qahtani, a top aide to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and General Ahmed al-Asiri, who served as deputy head of foreign intelligence, were among the planners in Khashoggi's death. The Saudi critic was killed in Istanbul's consulate on October 2nd. Last month, the U.S. Treasury slapped sanctions on 17 Saudis for their role in the murder. It included Qahtani, but not Asiri. The Saudi public prosecutor has said the order to repatriate Khashoggi came from Asiri. A travel ban has also been imposed on Qahtani. It's not clear, though, if the men are currently detained. Western states are continuing to press the kingdom for a credible investigation.
That's Emily Withers reporting from Istanbul. Environment ministers from nearly 200 countries are arriving in the Polish city of Katowice to discuss ways to advance the 2015 Paris Accord to curb climate change. Efforts are stuttering as several key nations have objected to a key UN-backed report on the impact of rising temperatures at the COP24 talks in Poland. Ahead of the ministerial arrivals, climate activists from around the world marched Saturday in the Polish city to vent their frustration and urge governments to wake up and make the planet green again. Environmental activist Philip McMaster said he's concerned about the state of the earth we are going to leave to our children.
We're heating up the planet. These children are going to live in a completely different world. They're going to live in a degraded world. Heated, agriculture will have enormous problems because of climatic shifts.
For oil-producing countries, the U.S., Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Russia opposed the inclusion of a recently released Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, which warned that global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius would require rapid, far-reaching, and unprecedented changes in all aspects of society. The report is likely to resurface in the final week of bargaining. Thule Montana of the British High Commission Pretoria says she hopes the lead negotiators will come to some concrete conclusions at the summit.
The second week is pertinent because that's when you have ministers and heads of delegation that are attending. So I'm really hoping that the technical nonsense will be pushed out of the way and that we can really get to the heart and the core of the matter.
National leaders have stayed away from this year's climate change conference largely because it's devoted to agreeing on the details of the implementation of the Paris Agreement, which the United States says it will withdraw from. Many developing nations say they are already suffering from the impact of climate change, especially in South Asia and Africa, where water shortages and intense storms are putting lives and livelihoods in danger. Henry Ridgewell has that part of the story.
5 months ago, a bustling fish market stood at Kachulu on the shores of Malawi's Lake Chilwa. Now, hundreds of fishing boats lie marooned across the vast bay as vultures circle over the cracked, sun-baked mud. Water levels here fluctuate annually, but scientists say climate change is making the seasonal dry out of the lake far more dramatic. Fishermen are being forced to leave and look for work elsewhere, says Sosten Chiota of the non-governmental organisation LEAD, Leadership for Environment and Development.
Climate change contributes to the current recessions that we are experiencing. Because you can see that in 2012, there was a recession where the lake lost about 80% of its water. Then it recovered in 2013, but not fully. So since then, every year, we've been experiencing these recessions.
Policymakers gathering at the COP24 climate talks say it is developing countries like Malawi that are being hit hardest by the impacts of climate change. The charity WaterAid has released a report ranking the countries worst hit by water shortages, with Sudan, Niger, and Pakistan making up the top three. WaterAid's Jonathan Farr spoke to VOA via Skype from the COP24 conference.
There's people who are living with the impacts of climate change right now, and they're feeling those impacts not through carbon but through water. And as we've seen over the past few years, and we'll continue to see for many years to come, unfortunately, is a huge increase in water stress and absolute water scarcity.
Richer nations have pledged $100 billion a year for poorer nations to deal with the consequences of climate change, but WaterAid says they are failing to deliver. Scientists say emissions of carbon dioxide would have to be reduced by 45% to have any hope of keeping global warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius, the target agreed in the Paris climate deal. But the number of coal-fired power stations, the most polluting form of energy generation, is growing. The German organisation Ergovolt calculates that $478 billion had been invested into expansion of the coal industry between January 2016 and September 2018, including in Africa. Ergovolt's director, Heffer Schücking.
14 African countries now, the first coal plants are being developed. It's completely crazy. Economies that could just be leapfrogging to a renewable energy economy that instead are having, largely by foreign companies, having coal plants being pushed on them as a solution to energy problems.
Meanwhile, the World Health Organization warns that climate change will exacerbate the impact of some diseases and health problems, including malaria, malnutrition, and heat exposure. There is little optimism at the talks that much concrete progress will be made, as several countries, including the United States, Russia, and Saudi Arabia, have already voiced objections to a key scientific report from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, peepsters. Welcome to the weekend. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Boy, do I have a show for you. 55 minutes of cool, commercial-free, pan-African music. Hear your favorite current Afro beats. Discover new music from Ghana and meet Blinky Bill from Nairobi. He's just released a new album.
Even if you know a lot of things, there's no guarantee that you're gonna see it tomorrow.
Revel in earthy African classics from Mali, Cape Verde, DRC, and South Africa. All this and more this Sunday at 15:05 and 20:05 UTC. Just tune in to your local FM station and meet me there. Music Time in Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, a new collaborative research project between Indiana University and the Australian National University is aiming to make democracies more resilient at a time when they're under increasing strain. The findings came out of a collaborative workshop held in Washington titled Making Democracy Harder to Hack. With all the drama involving elections in the United States, from Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election to voting problems in the midterms, I talked to Dr. Adam Henschke, senior lecturer at the National Security College at the Australian National University, about the motivation behind the research.
We at the National Security College have had a growing interest, as a lot of people have had, in the impacts of foreign activity on domestic electoral processes. It was probably sparked by the 2016 US election, and then what we were trying to do was understand what lessons we could learn for Australia from the US experience. And then off the back of those mutual interests, we then participated in a workshop with Indiana University in Washington, and that was looking at how to make democracy harder to hack. And again, we saw, you know, a lot of similarities in the sorts of things that we were looking at, but then some interesting differences between the US experience, the Australian experience, and also the US voting context and the Australian voting context.
So what did you, what did the research find?
Well, one of the really obvious differences between the US and Australia is how we actually vote. So Australia has compulsory voting. I think we're one of three maybe countries in the world that has compulsory voting. But also, and this comes as a surprise, I think, to a lot of Australians, our voting processes are centrally coordinated. We still generally have kind of physical voting, so you write with a bit of pen and paper. And then when we're at this workshop with Indiana Uni, the level of difference that happens in the US voting practices, you know, from the state and to the county level, the range of people involved, the private, I guess the role of private companies in voting, it seems so, to my mind at least, vastly different to what Australians experience. So that was one of the real shocks, was just to see how variable voting practices are in the US. And then, given that we're looking at making democracy harder to hack, we were then looking at, okay, given all these variation within the US, does that then present a whole bunch of different points of vulnerability to voting and, I guess, democratic integrity more generally?
Basically, what I'm hearing is that to prevent cyber hacks and make democracies less vulnerable, the good old-fashioned pencil and paper ballot system is what you came up with as something that would be able to sort of prevent all that.
It definitely seems to lessen the likelihood of, let's say, kind of points of vulnerability around cyber. So this is one of the interesting things that came up at the workshop. We had quite a number of, you know, cyber experts, tech experts, people interested in electronic voting. And normally these people are somewhat technological positive, as in they're like, ah, you know, technology is great, and if we design technology properly, that can be better than an old system. But at this workshop, quite a number of them were saying, actually, maybe something like a pen and paper is the solution to a lot of the cyber vulnerabilities, because if you've got a bit of pen and paper, it might slow things down a little, but it obviously reduces and significantly reduces the number of vulnerabilities or entry points to mess with the actual voting outcome.
So what's your ultimate advice for countries like the United States that have had continuous problems?
This is the hard thing. Again, like the simple, or for my mind, the simple solution is centrally coordinated voting, where you have a central body that oversees the voting processes and overall election processes in a similar way to the Australian Electoral Commission does here in Australia. That, it seems, would be, I'm not sure about this, but that would be very hard to institute in the United States. I guess the bearing or taking that into account, the next step then is trying to learn from each other's experiences and mistakes and then be a bit more careful about what happens in the future. So this is the other thing that we were trying to take away from this workshop was, okay, what things can Australia learn from the US? We're likely to have a federal election in Australia next year. So what are the sorts of things that foreign actors, particularly Russia and perhaps China, have done in the US that Australia can learn from? And also, given Australia's geographic location, we've probably got a little bit more experience and sensitivity to actors like China than the US has. So what things can we pass on to the US about foreign actors with perhaps different strategic interests than what Russia might have?
That's Dr. Adam Henschke, senior lecturer at the National Security College at the Australian National University. With no new wide releases, there's little change at the North American box office this weekend, though there has been a superhero sighting. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
Ralph, isn't this great?
Ralph Breaks the Internet is having a heck of a run.
We are going to the Internet!
Super excited!
Disney's animated sequel about video game characters exploring the Internet remains number one for a third straight week.
Holy cow!
Though ticket sales dropped to just over 16 million. The top five remained unchanged in a quiet weekend in theaters. The Grinch is at number two, followed by Creed 2, Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald, and Bohemian Rhapsody. But the big noise was made in China.
What could be greater than a king?
Where Aquaman made its debut.
A hero.
It'll arrive in North America amid a Christmas storm of movies. I'm Ben Thomas.
Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
This is V.